This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about coverage of COP26. Frontline communities are right now tweeting, basically saying that the agreements just do not go far enough. We've been talking about some of these agreements, countries agreeing to phase out coal financing, cutting methane emissions, halting deforestation, helping vulnerable countries fight the crisis. But what do these agreements actually mean, and what is missing? Today, we're joined by Mark Hertzgaard, Executive Director of Covering Climate Now, a global journalism initiative committed to more and better coverage of the climate story. Mark is environment correspondent for The Nation and author of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. Hi, Mark. Thanks for joining us again.
Hi, Rose. I'm here in Glasgow. Can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you. You sound great.
Good.
Mark, can you give us the latest? I'm reading some tweets from a lot of young activists, indigenous activists, and they're sounding very upset. The COP draft agreement puts us at a 2.4 Celsius of warming. This is just unacceptable. So can you give us the latest? What's happening right now?
Sure. First, I should say that there's a lot of negotiation ahead. This was supposed to officially end a couple hours ago. We are clearly going to go through the night and probably well into Saturday and perhaps even Sunday, I just heard. I just came from a press conference here where representatives of the Global South were little short of furious with the opposition that they say is taking place inside of the negotiating rooms around the issues of, in particular, loss and damage and rich countries paying poor countries for the climate losses and damages that are being sustained. And, of course, the poor countries point out that it's the rich countries, especially the United States and Europe, and now increasingly China, whose emissions have caused global warming, whereas the poor countries in Africa and Asia are responsible for literally less than 10% of the whole problem. And that's why the Paris Agreement 6 years ago enshrined a pledge by the rich countries that they would provide poorer countries $100 billion a year, intended both to help those countries shift to clean energy sources, but also to adapt to the rising temperatures, the worsening droughts, the sea level rise, the floods, etc., that are already happening. That $100 billion has not been provided. That's been one of the big, I think flashpoints is not too strong a word to use, here in Glasgow over the last week. And then in addition to that adaptation, there is this new argument around so-called loss and damage. And loss and damage refers to things that cannot be undone. You know, I was writing this week, for example, about some villages in Bangladesh that have literally been washed away because the floods coming down from the Himalayas are bigger now with the snow melting due to higher temperatures. That's the kind of loss that it cannot be restored. And so these countries are saying that they should get compensation for that. I just came from a press conference where one of the chief NGO representatives from the Global South, Mohammed Adao, from a group called Power Shift Africa, was lambasting the Biden administration and saying that although Joe Biden has talked a good game as a presidential candidate about running on climate justice and has tried to deliver on that in his domestic agenda with the so-called Build Back Better legislation that's now facing a vote in Congress probably next week, Mr. Adao said that Joe Biden, who is doing climate work domestically, that's the Joe Biden that we need to show up here in Glasgow, because according to Adao, the U.S. and the European Union countries in particular, behind closed doors, are absolutely, as he put it, the biggest block, unquote, for progress on these issues.
Well, that was the next question I wanted to ask you, Mark, since you're there. Can you give us a sense of how the decisions are made and who has a seat at the table? Because climate scientist Professor Catherine Hayhoe tweeted, "The bad news, the latest COP26 has been watered down terribly overnight, backing away from a call to end all use of coal and phase out fossil fuel subsidies completely in the earlier draft and changing renewables to low emission fuels." And then Alexandria Villasenor who is a very, she's an amazing young activist. She wrote, civil society was completely shocked at the changes made overnight. So tell us how this all gets done, Mark.
Sure, happy to do that. I have to say, I think those are I would not share those particular interpretations of what happened to the draft text, the agreement here. What happens is that the so-called parties, that's capital P parties to the agreement, those are the countries, the 197 countries who signed the Paris Agreement. And bear in mind, Rose, that what we're talking about here in Glasgow is about how to implement the Paris Agreement. It's not a new agreement that's trying to be reached here. It's about how do you implement what all these countries signed on to 6 years ago, particularly the pledge to limit global temperature rises close to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels as possible. And, of course, the science tells us in the subsequent 6 years that that's really, really important, that beyond 1.5C, it gets very, very tough for civilization as we know it to continue. So what happens is that the negotiators from these 197 countries, they meet, and they've been meeting for months now, but then here in Glasgow, they meet and they go through a text of a document that is the what they are trying to agree here. It's very important to recognize, though, that it is all by consensus. It's not majority rule. So if there's any one country that says, no, I'm just not going to sign on to that, it gets knocked out of the agreement. Now, it's not quite that cut and dried because, of course, different countries have influence with other countries, and there's only so far that certain countries can go to block progress. Saudi Arabia, in particular, is well known for blocking progress over the years. So the negotiators meet. There has never been civil society representation inside of those negotiating rooms. Those are all government delegations. What Alexandria is talking about, I think, is that civil society, which is a very important part of this process, civil society representatives, especially from the global south, were not even able to arrive here in Glasgow in order to do protests, to hold so-called side events where they can make their arguments about what the negotiators inside of those closed rooms, behind closed doors, should be doing. That's very true. Now, there have been two drafts of the text that have been outlined. One came on Wednesday. That was the initial draft. And that was remarkable because for the first time in all of these 26 years of UN climate negotiations, the agreement finally mentioned the words fossil fuels. Hmm. That has never happened before, which is pretty crazy when you stop to think about it, because fossil fuels, of course, are the main reason that we face a climate emergency. So there was a lot of excitement here initially that first draft said we should phase, this was the exact quote, phase out coal and phase out coal and subsidies to fossil fuels, unquote. So phase out coal and subsidies to fossil fuels, unquote. That language has indeed changed in the draft that was released this morning, Friday morning here in Glasgow. That was the second draft. And it calls for phasing out unabated coal and softens the language also around the fossil fuel subsidies. Unabated coal means coal use that is not accompanied by so-called carbon capture and storage, meaning technologies that when you burn the coal, they nevertheless capture the CO2 before it enters the atmosphere. That's a real sticking point for a lot of activists and indeed scientists who point out that carbon capture and storage technologies, although they do exist, are not yet at implemented at scale and at a commercial level. So there is, you know, these are all things that are still in play. But I would say that probably the most contentious issue at the moment is around this loss and damage. And the fact that, as I said earlier, a lot of the voices out of the global south, especially the NGO community, are blasting the U.S. and the EU nations for being supposedly the biggest block on progress on that front.
We talked about a New York Times piece that came out around the agreement on, I want to get this right, to phase out coal financing. And according to the New York Times, the Biden administration said that Senator Joe Manchin just wouldn't go for it. So can you give us any more insight about the role that the United States is playing?
Sure. Well, look, the United States is the single greatest climate superpower on Earth, trailed not that far by China. But the United States is the largest historical emitter of greenhouse gases. And this is a mistake that I'm sorry that my colleagues in the media make all the time. They describe China as the biggest emitter. That is true on an annual basis. China has passed the United States in terms of its annual emissions. But the United States has put still quite a few more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere historically. And the atmosphere cares about historical, not the annual increases, but the amount that's already up there. So, and of course, in addition to that, the United States is the richest economy in the world. It has enormous political and diplomatic leverage over other countries. And so when, including, by the way, the United Kingdom, which is the host government here, and whose representative, Alex Sharma, is the president of COP26, and his role there is to try and find consensus among all these 197 countries. But the accusation just made at this press conference by the Global South NGOs is that essentially the British government is caving to pressure from the United States and the European Union not to deal with loss and damage and other issues. One other quick note on that, on the coal announcement. You know, the United States and China did issue a very important statement the other day here that that U.S. and China are going to work together on climate carbon dioxide emission reductions in 2020, also methane reductions. But it's really important with all of these things, Rose, to remember that announcements are not agreements. And again, often the media coverage on this has been lacking in clarity. The announcements that were made last week about methane, about ending deforestation by 2030, these are not agreements. They are not part of whatever is finally agreed here at Glasgow. Those are unilateral or occasionally multilateral announcements by governments saying this is what we will do. And almost all of those announcements, as the reporting has correctly pointed out, are very, very sparse on the details of how they will do it, the money that will be spent to do it. And in most cases, the countries making those promises do not have policies in place or even described in the announcements for how they're going to achieve an end to coal, an end to deforestation, and so forth.
So, Mark, where does that leave us? Because you've got, like, the UN, for example, coming out with a recent report saying the world needs to cut half its production of fossil fuels, half in the coming decade, to maintain a chance of keeping up with global targets.
Well, here, let me give you one of the pieces of good news, Rose, since I've not provided that yet. But in fact, I just filed a story of an hour ago that there is some unambiguously good news here in Glasgow that actually could still snatch victory from the jaws of defeat over time. And that is that there is a provision buried inside of this text that's being negotiated that would require all of the governments to come back next year and every year thereafter with new climate action plans that will describe what they will do between now and 2030 to meet the 1.5 degree target. And all of the science, including the UN numbers that you mentioned a moment ago, all say that if we are going to limit to 1.5 degrees, what matters is what countries do between now and 2030, not what they say they're going to do by 2050. If we're going to get to where we need to be by 2050, you have to take enormous action in the next 9 years. And what's significant about the this idea that governments will come back every year is that it gives civil society, the media, and also other governments who want action, it gives them far more opportunities to put sustained pressure on the fossil fuel states like the United States and the others that don't want to make action. So I had a quote from in my story from the Greenpeace International Executive Director, Jennifer Morgan, saying that, look, we're now on track for 2.4 degrees, which would be disastrous around the world. So it's just not even an option to wait 5 years to revisit these talks, which is the current plan. So all of the civil society leaders that I've talked to here welcome this plan to come back a year from now and every year thereafter so that you force these governments to face pressure. I know a lot of people are very cynical about these kinds of COP talks, but in fact, the whole reason that we're talking about a 1.5 degree target today is because of the Paris cop. And because governments come here and they have to face the music, they have to talk to other governments, they have to talk to the press and take their questions. So I think that's the biggest reason for optimism I see going forward, along with some new science that points out, you know, we're actually not locked into a lot of future temperature rise. If we end greenhouse gas emissions quickly, the temperatures stop going up. So that's why, again, if we can get these annual meetings where governments have to say, here's what we're going to do by 2030, we actually can make real pressure if civil society jumps on that opportunity to push them.
Final 2 minutes, Mark, can you just give us a sense of what you're hearing and seeing from the activists on the streets? I just searched for Indigenous COP26, and actually there's quite a lot of coverage. The Guardian, NPR, Vogue, CNN, a couple other, Manga Bay, because Indigenous activists, in many cases, have led a lot of these rallies. Indigenous women have spoken out saying femicide is linked to ecocide. So just leave us with some final thoughts about the activism at COP26.
You're right that there's been a lot of that coverage. I'm proud to say that a lot of those outlets doing that coverage are partners of Covering Climate Now, like Vogue, like The Guardian, and others. And yeah, you see these Indigenous leaders around, both here inside the COP, but also at the big protest I wrote about it last Saturday, where there was a number of Indigenous leaders who were saying, look, we are the people who can tell all the rest of you how to save yourselves. Listen to what our ancient knowledge about. We've got to be protecting the earth, not using it as an extractive mechanism, but rather recognizing that if we take care of it, it will take care of us. So that is, I think, a very welcome shift, really, from previous COPs. And it's especially welcome, as you say, that the media is giving those voices the kind of prominence that they've long deserved.
So we're going to expect some major announcements on Saturday or Sunday?
I doubt very strongly we'll hear anything further tonight. But yes, certainly Saturday and maybe Sunday. We'll just have to wait and see.
All right. Mark Hertzgaard is Executive Director of Covering Climate Now, Environment Correspondent for The Nation, and author of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years. Mark was joining us from COP26. Thank you so much, Mark, for your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Rose.
Thank you. And we will definitely bring you updates about what happens over the weekend at COP on Your Call next week. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering the show. You can find all of this week's shows at yourcallradio.org. Be sure to sign up for our podcast. If you listen on iTunes, leave us a review. You can also interact with us on Twitter at Your Call Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.